Les Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. Its 20th edition runs March 1st to 21st in all communities across Canada. The Canadian Foundation for Cross-Cultural Dialogue, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, and this station present Les RVF Marathon, which aims to promote language duality in Canada across the country. Stay tuned for this marathon day of 20th Rendez-vous de la Francophonie and visit www.ncra.ca/RVF for more information on this event.
Shannon has been doing the HOMO show on CKUT for 2 years.
And we've called it the HOMO show on purpose because we didn't want to make any euphemisms. I find the word gay is even a little too euphemistic. I'm not overly comfortable with that. We wanted to be blatant about it. We have a lesbian show called Dykes on Mikes, and that, I mean, there's no mistaking what it is. And so this was a part of the notion of visibility that the show would give us.
It's almost like a joke, because when I heard it, I just chuckled, because it sounds like Air Farce or one of those other shows that it almost sounds like a parody or a takeoff on itself.
I think it's a takeoff on the notion that gay people, first of all, are always sort of foaming at the mouth and militant, and there's a lot of sense of humor. I mean, gay people practically invented the notion of humor.
This is Anna Lasovich reporting for CKUT Montreal, an NCRA member station, on the 20th anniversary of the Rendez-vous de la Francophonie. What you just heard was an interview from the CBC archives with the recently deceased David Shannon. Shannon was a Montreal LGBT activist, a co-founding member of the city's AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP chapter, as well as a prolific journalist. He also hosted the HOMO show on CKUT from the same studio I'm sitting in today. 20 years later, LGBT issues have moved away from the margins. But it's easy to forget how recently this all came into place. A similar memory bias also applies for women in this province. Women in Quebec obtained the right to vote in 1940. That's 20 years later than anywhere else in the country. In 1959, Quebec was the only province that refused to sign legislation ensuring equal pay for equal work. So what do we do knowing this? How do we move forward without glossing over the struggle? The short answer is literature. In 2016, the Le Guélien Collective opened a new bookstore and community space, specialized in feminist and LGBT literature in Montreal's gay village. A few weeks ago, I spoke to one of the founding members, Stéphane Dufresne.
So my name is Stéphanie, and I'm a bookseller here at Le Guélien Feminist Bookstore, and I'm also one of the founding members of the bookstore.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the project started?
Sure. So it started 2 years ago now. So what happened is that a couple of people had this idea, each on their side, of opening a feminist bookstore like one day in their life. And eventually the word started circulating that, like, oh, I know someone who's also interested in that idea. And we ended up being all put in contact, like through friends or people we knew. And eventually all met together. There was like maybe a dozen people at this first meeting. And the call was like, okay, like, we're all juggling with this idea. Like, can we make it a serious project? And like, are we into making this happen for real? Or is this just a dream that, you know, we're hoping someone's going to do it someday? And there were enough people who were highly like committed to the idea and highly motivated. And so a core group of six people formed, who were like, okay, we're doing this. We're going to open a feminist bookstore in Montreal. So that happened 2 years ago. those six people, so it was me, Nicolas, Marie-Ève, Camille, Sandrine, and Karine, we decided to launch a crowdfunding campaign. And the crowdfunding campaign was, so it was a way to raise money, but also a way to kind of test, like, to see, is there a public for that? There's like, is there a community or there are communities that are interested beyond us and like our close circle of friends who think that this is a good idea and like who would use such a space. And the crowdfunding campaign works super well. We were hoping to raise $25,000, which was already like a pretty high amount for us. We like were not even sure we would be able to raised that much money, but we knew that like we had made calculations and we knew that this is what we would need to open the space. And we raised over $32,000, which was really exciting and a great success. But also like more than the money that we raised, we realized that like we got a lot of messages from people and there was like a high level of enthusiasm for the project and from very different like networks or groups of people. There was kind of a confirmation like, okay, there's a real interest for such a space to exist. And so when the campaign ended, we met and we looked at the results and we were like, okay, we're doing this. We're going to open a feminist bookstore in Montreal.
How do you all bring your different interests and different facets of feminism to the project?
So when we think about the bookstore and especially it being at the feminist bookstore, so it's a feminist and LGBTQ plus racialized and indigenous literatures bookstore. And when we think about it, we explicitly don't think about it as the bookstore of one feminism, but rather a bookstore of feminisms, plural. I mean, it was important for us as a principle per se, but it also came or was nourished, that principle, by the fact that we all come from different backgrounds, have different identities, different life experiences, and also different feminist ideas and sensibilité, like sensitivities. Yeah. And I mean, we agree on core principles and core values. Obviously, that's important when you work as a collective, and especially in our case, as a non-hierarchical collective. But we also allowed for a space to exist for those differences and different like sensibilité, inclinations, because we think they're bringing like richness and diversity to the space and to how we conceive feminisms, so that they're not rigid and they're not fixed, that they can evolve, that we can discuss, that we can learn from each other also. And so that's for the team and for how we work together. But also we think that the space that we wanted to be in, a space that's open, that's inclusive, that's diverse, that's welcoming, that's a space for, you know, exchanges, discussions, new ideas, could benefit from us bringing our different perspectives in the space, and that they can coexist, they can cohabit in that space, either with events, with like networks of people or communities that we are invested in and contribute in, and also obviously in the collection of books that we carry in the bookstore.
So Dagenian gets its name from a sci-fi novel published in Quebec. And I was just wondering, maybe you could talk a little bit about how sci-fi and feminism overlap, because a lot of people don't see that connection.
Yes, I would say, and it's not an idea that comes from me, it comes from an anthology called Octavius Brun. Social justice work is science fiction work in some way, because to be able to envision the world as something different than what it is now, you need to be able to have that, like, to use your imagination and to have that projection, and then kind of like create that vision that you want to reach, that makes you want to work in the present to change things. And so in some way, like, science fiction, this it's exactly the work that a science fiction writer will do. They will imagine the world either like in an apocalyptic way, like how things that are already going bad could go worse, to make sure that we know where we could head and that we work to not go there, or conversely, to create those possibilities in our minds of how things could change and they could be better. And I think that it is by knowing, but also feeling, and this is the power of narrative and stories, to feel those possibilities that we can't experience in the current world, can be a very powerful incentive or motor to act.
Can you tell us about the used book collection?
Sure. So here we have new books, but also used books. Many of them come from people who had heard about the opening of a feminist bookstore. And I think many older people who had accumulated a pretty interesting collection of books during their life and who wanted to pass them on to someone else, but were still attached to many of those books, and they were books that were important for them in their life trajectory. They didn't want to just give them away to Renaissance, or they wanted those books to find someone who would like them and love them, maybe as they had been in the past. Yeah, kind of an inheritance. And so many people came with boxes and boxes of awesome collection of books that were super relevant to the mandate that we have here. And I think that they were kind of waiting for such a space to exist, or they felt confident that the books would find good owner, a new public that would be interested in them, and they wouldn't just get lost or destroyed or disappear. And so many of the used books that we have came from those donations. There are some that we also look for and buy that are books that are difficult to get, that we find important that they circulate. Stone Butch Blues is one of them. Yeah, books that were not reprinted. And sadly, it's really an issue with feminist queer books. Many of them don't get reprinted, and so they're hard to find because they don't circulate in print that much anymore. So we pay attention to trying to find those books and put them in circulation and making sure that they can reach new readers. Yeah, and we also have a lot of books that we sell for just $1 because we wanted to also have books that would be accessible financially.
Was it a conscious choice that you wanted to open a bookstore in the gay village because of there's so much history behind it in Montreal, or was this just a space that became available?
It was a conscious choice. We looked for a long time for this space. We visited I don't know how many spaces. Access to space in, I was going to say in this city, but I think it's true in many cities, is it's such an issue. Space is a super rare and difficult to access resource because it's regimented by the capitalist system. And so it was very, we had to look for a long time for a space that we could afford, that would be accessible. And yeah, especially commercial space. There's no, either it's a space that you rent to live in or a commercial space, but there's no in-between for not-for-profit or community organization or community space, or at least it's very rare, and there are less or less of those spaces. So that's my political message answering to your question. But we were looking in this district specifically. We wanted to be close to the village. It was important to us. There is a lot of history in that neighborhood. And also we thought that having a feminist space in the village was an interesting kind of new addition to the ecosystem that exists here in the village. And also it was related to the history. There was L'Androgyne. There was an LGBTQ bookstore that was on Amherst for a while in this neighborhood that closed, unfortunately. And also here, this exact space where we are, was a fetish cafe before, not just before we came in. It was over 10 years ago. We found out after. But so we thought that it was something interesting in connecting to that history of the village and how it was an important space for marginalized communities to meet, organize.
What is a fetish cafe?
It was a cafe where people of the fetish community would meet and exchange and get together. Yeah. And yeah, it's interesting. It's an anecdote, but there was a launch, a book launch here, and two, I don't want to say older, middle-aged gay men came. And they were like, oh, yes, I remember, like, this used to be the Fetish Cafe, and they were regulars of the place, and, like, they remember it was part of their, you know, history of that space and of the village. So this kind of, like, connection with the history was important for us. And as well, we wanted to be mindful of other indie bookstore that are already operating, yeah, in the city, and how these bookstores kind of like build, you know, communities around them in their neighborhoods. So we kind of mapped like all the neighborhoods that were already covered, so to speak, and wanted to not be too close because we wanted to be kind of in solidarity with that already fragile ecosystem of indie bookstores.
How did you divide the book sections?
Mm-hmm. That was a very difficult decision to make because there's no perfect answer, and like we could have used like a whole other system that could have worked very well as well. We just had to like choose one, and also there's already some form of classification that happens before the books arrive in a bookstore. Like publishers and the distributors, they all add cues or metadata. Some categories that you will see like in the more grande surface, like big chain bookstores, didn't really make sense. Like the way we categorize books is political in some way. So we wanted to also think about that. So if like, for instance, and it's not a question that we've like came with a definite answer to, but if you separate, just random example, not so random, but if you separate the fiction and then you have another section that's lesbian fiction, is that a good thing because it's making visible and like easy to find some lesbian section mm-hmm. fiction for people who are looking for that? Or are you implying that lesbian fiction is not part of the norm and has to be kind of like put aside? Yeah. So it's not an easy question. I don't think there's it's dependent on context and it's dependent on who's coming, the reception. And yeah, so for now, what we've decided is that we have broad sections like fiction and then everything's in the fiction section, whatever subsection it could belong to. And also like, how do you, if you have like a, I don't know, Black lesbian author, do you put it in like Black literature or lesbian literature? Like, you know, how do you decide which identity category? Do you use the author's identity or the themes in the book? Like it becomes really difficult to like trancher. And also there's a risk of boxing, like putting people or their book, their artwork, they're writing in a box, which can be limiting. So yeah, so what we've decided is that there's one section that's fiction, and then everything's in that section by alphabetical order. That's for now. Maybe it's going to change. Maybe it's going to evolve. We allow ourselves also to change if feel the need.
It's like a really interesting topic now that I think about it, because it's either by labeling something, you're either creating a distance with somebody or creating a kinship. So yeah, someone who identifies with that label could go straight to that section, or someone who doesn't would be like, uh-huh, I guess, kind of intimidated by it. But yeah, I'm just thinking like if I was looking for like a James Baldwin book, where would I go?
Well, you would find some here in the fiction section and some also in the memoir section. And we also have some in the nonfiction section.
Great. So
everywhere.
If you're looking for a James Baldwin book, this is the place to go.
You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world. But then you read. It was books that taught me. The things that tormented me the most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive or had ever been alive. I went to the 135th Street Library at least three or four times a week. And I read everything there, I mean every single book in that library. In some blind and instinctive way, I knew that what was happening in those books was also happening all around me. And I was trying to make a connection between the books and the life I saw and the life I lived.
I knew I was black, of course, but I also knew I was smart. I didn't know how I would use my mind, or even if I could. But that was the only thing I had to use. And I was going to get whatever I wanted that way. And I was going to get my revenge that way. So I watched school where I watched the streets. Because part of the answer was there.
That was a short clip from an interview with James Baldwin in 1963. In addition to hosting book launches, Le Guélien also provides space for Gender Blender, a queer open mic hosted by Camilla Mackerel. To close off, let's listen to a piece by Kama entitled One Syllabled Pronoun, recorded in 2015.
A weekend in the life of Camilla Mackerel. Saturday, 10 a.m., anti-oppression workshop. Saturday, 4 p.m., queer writing circle. Sunday, 11 a.m., People of Color Brunch. Sunday, 4 p.m., Harm Reduction Collective Meeting. And then Sunday, 9 p.m. I am on OkCupid. I am on OkCupid on a Sunday night, and in her latest email to me, she pops the question, "So, you say in your profile that you are trans. Which pronoun do you prefer?" 5 times. Five times over one weekend where I get asked, which pronoun do you prefer? Which pronoun do you use? Which pronoun do you go by? Which pronoun are you more comfortable with? Which pronoun do you identify with? Anti-oppression workshop? Fine. Queer writing circle? Sounds about right. People of color brunch? True. Harm reduction collective meeting? Definitely. But OkCupid? Seriously, OkCupid? Out of the thousands of assholes sending pictures of their genitalia across the entangled erotic web that is OkCupid, out of the hundreds of people who understand gender as a binary, male or female, this is not a spectrum, there's nothing in between, out of the dozens of liberal academics on OkCupid, you know, those who have read Judith Butler and Jacques Halberstam and Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida and Schaeffer, and still cannot ever grasp that gender is not just a theoretical concept, that gender is not an intellectual game that is played for the sake of papers being written and theses being drafted, that gender is not a playground upon which we will compete to show to each other how much knowledge we have, how much our brains can be stimulated, our intellect masturbated for the sake of what? A gender theory. And then, out of all the so-called liberal queer community organizers on OkCupid, all those who have done an anti-o workshop and know how to walk the walk and talk the talk and carry their anti-oppressive badge like a medal that is owed to them after what? After you did a 3-hour anti-oppression workshop 2 years ago? And they brand their anti-oppression like a university credit but still cannot understand that anti-oppression is a way of life to be integrated in the very nature of their organizing, in their everyday living. And yet, they say racist shit to my face all the time and mutilate my gender pronoun every single time because even if they care to ask me, it's protocol after all to ask somebody for their preferred gender pronoun. That's what anti-oppressive queers do. And yet, never respect the answer. Oh wait, did you even wait for an answer when you asked me the question? And keep on cutting up my gender in those tiny little pieces like confetti at a wedding, who keep butchering my pronoun like mince meat under an automated metal blade, and keep poking at my gender identity like random scraps of metal on a wall, the kinds of shards that get entangled in a pantyhose and tear a hole that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and tear at the very fabric of my being. So out of the assholes, the liberal academics, and the so-called anti-oppressive queers, I fell on the one person on OkCupid, the one person who actually asked me for my preferred gender pronoun, and might actually care to respect it. I take a sip of green tea, and I tap my nail-coated fingers on my desk. simulating phrases and sentences that I dare not type, haunted thoughts bringing into being ghost words, factitious and fictitious. How do I capture in one word, in one syllable, the confusion of my gender, the trouble of a lived experience that is only skin deep and yet so heavily embodied, a gender that only shows itself at the surface and yet slips through the cracks and trickles through my veins, all the way to my heavy heart. How do I tell her that I was assigned male at birth, that at age 6 I had the sissy beaten out of me, that at age 12 I was bullied and called a faggot, but that at age 21 I discovered male privilege? How do I tell her about my complicit relationship with patriarchy and misogyny, of how seriously everybody takes me for being male, of the amount of space that is given to me because of the tone of my voice and the validation that is granted to me because of my thick beard? How do I tell her that maybe I do not want to forego my male privilege, that maybe I want to benefit from a sexist system that sanctions me with approval and attests to its gender domination by endorsing my existence? How do I tell her that I still can't find a one-syllable pronoun? A one-syllable pronoun that acknowledges my history and my legacy, that colonialism maps itself on bodies like an imprint inscribed onto our DNA, that colonization was a carefully crafted strategy to subjugate black and brown masculinities, to render the brown and black male weak, effeminized, emasculated, castrated? How do I tell her that my gender dysphoria is also my racial trauma, that male privilege is only authorized by the dominating aesthetics of white patriarchy, and that for as long as colonization will run in my veins, for as long as male privilege will seep out of my vocal cords, my beard, my thick beard of patriarchy, will only be a site of racial and colonial trauma? How do I tell her that this depository of sexism only grants male privilege to skinny white boys? By the way, being a Milan hipster is so cool. But that on a body like mine, this site of sexism becomes a sign of terrorism, a brown body to be scared of, to be policed, controlled, regulated, stopped, emasculated, castrated, all over again in history, repeating itself within the economy of colonial masculinities where gender is yet another pawn to uphold white supremacist patriarchy, sexism, and misogyny. I take a sip of green tea, and I tap my nail-coated fingers on my desk. One syllable, one pronoun, one chance at homogenizing my atemporal gender and pinging it down to one location. K-A-M-A. Kama. Just call me Kama.
Thank you to Stephanie for the interview and to Kama for permission to use the piece. This has been Anna Lasovich reporting for CKUT Montreal, an NCRA member station, on the 20th anniversary of the Rendezvous de la Francophonie. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for joining us for this marathon day of the 20th Rendezvous de la Francophonie, presented by the Canadian Foundation for Cross-Cultural Dialogue, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, and this station. For more information on les Rendezvous de la Francophonie events, or to provide feedback on the show, visit www.rvf.ca.